Hi, I'm Tess Vegland, hoping for some good news this time.
So there is a little bit of a silver lining in this, even though all of us have a lot of reasons to be apprehensive about what's going on out there today.
Not quite what we were looking for, but okay. Sometimes you can find hope in the eyes and words of a child. This one says, if mom and dad lose their shirts on Wall Street,
I would just not buy anything.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
We'll explore how to talk to the Wiggles set about WAMU and Wall Street. Meanwhile, on the other end of the age spectrum,
it's been very nerve-wracking. I estimate that I have lost $120,000 in the past 18 months.
We've got perspective and perseverance on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, this is Marketplace Money. It feels a little overwhelming, doesn't it? For you, for me, certainly for the government. Our coverage of the financial crisis continues this weekend with another deep breath. I'm Tess Vigeland. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider that offers products and planning tools to help their nearly 3 million members and their communities thrive. More at thrivent.com.
Seems to me there were two overarching themes to what happened in our financial world this week. Here's a sampling from President Bush, Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson, and Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke.
Our entire economy is in danger.
I am convinced that this bold approach will cost American families far less than the alternative.
Action by the Congress is urgently required to stabilize the situation and avert what otherwise could be very serious consequences for our financial markets and for our economy.
The second theme revolved around a seething public that either doesn't believe those dire pronouncements or most certainly doesn't believe in the $700 billion proposed solution. So let's take a step back with our own Chris Farrell. Hi, Chris.
Hello, Tess.
Honestly, you listen to those three gentlemen, and they're not the only ones this week, and you would think that we are somewhere near financial Armageddon. But what I want to ask you, what would happen if we just let this ride? What would that really look like?
Okay, so here's the fear. The credit markets freeze up, and then it spills over not just to homeowners, but into businesses, and businesses start laying off people. And then their banks are failing, and banks get nervous because they don't want to lend anymore because they want to preserve their capital. And then what happens is, as we saw in the Great Depression, the economy shrank by a third. Unemployment went to 25%. And now we've never had debt levels such as we have today. So I can spin out a nightmare scenario that says with the kind of leverage we have in our economy today, it could be even bigger.
All right. Well, with that picture painted, we've had a couple of folks ask this week, you know, we've been hearing about this credit freeze, this credit crunch for months on end now. And yet, you know, I am still getting credit card solicitation offers in the mail. Has that freeze not trickled down to us yet? And how would it?
You're absolutely right. This is the puzzlement on Main Street. 2.9% credit card offer comes in the mail.
Right.
What credit crunch? It's a spillover effect. When AIG got into trouble, the great fear was that AIG had used its balance sheet to guarantee a lot of debt throughout the system. And as that debt would explode, then you would have less credit out there. There are two sources of real debt problem today. One is the household, and one is the financial services system. The household and the financial services system are intimately linked. So the more we have trouble in financial services, the more that's going to spill over into Main Street, no matter what happens. We're in a recession, and the recession's going to get worse.
Chris, the other kind of piece of this is that this crisis represents a change in our financial lives. What will that look like?
You know, Tess, you listen over the years what we talk about, being careful with your borrowing, diversified portfolio, all that. That is going to become a necessity. So to a large extent, part of what the change is, we're going to go back to a more conservative financial posture with the household. And to a large extent, what I think the outcome or the way to sort of be trying to judge this is, there's a difference between the interests of markets and the consumer and the interests of industry. And as we go forward, we're going to try and define a system that benefits the consumer more than it benefits industry. But boy, that is going to be a tough battle that will go on for the next quarter century.
Chris, as you know, we've gotten hundreds and hundreds of emails and calls over the last week, and we'll get to those later on in the show in Getting Personal. So until then, I will thank you so much.
Thanks a lot, Tess.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider that offers products and planning tools to help their nearly 3 million members and their communities thrive. More at thrivent.com. And by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. The Marketplace Entrepreneurship Desk is supported by the Kauffman Foundation, online at kauffman.org.
Chris talked about how this will eventually trickle down to all of us. If you're a few decades from cashing in your retirement fund, you may still be thinking, who cares? But if you've just retired or plan to soon, it is an entirely different story. You can't afford to watch your 401ks become 1Ks. We checked in with some listeners who are in that situation. First is Marcia in Yucaipa, California.
I retired at age 50, and I am now 51. Yes, I realize I'm incredibly lucky, and I know that, but it's been very nerve-wracking. I estimate that I have lost $120,000 in the past 18 months. I've found that it's very hard to find employment. Not picky, I would take anything, but because you got, you know, nearly 10% unemployment where I'm at, it's pretty much been shut down.
Jerry from Baltimore, and I'm 60. I have felt panic before, you know, 1987, oh, this isn't good, 2001, 2002. I don't even feel panicked at this point. It just looks like the formula's changed. I'm going to need this nest egg we've built in possibly 6 to 7 years. Suddenly, my long haul is possibly equal to the recovery period from something this drastic. I'm heading for cash at a high speed.
My name's Mariana, and I live in Walla Walla, Washington, 72 years old. I work for a health information publishing company. I've been there for 21 years, and it looks like I might have to be there for a few more the way things are going. My company started a 401k several years ago. It's currently at 29% in stocks and 71% in bonds. The high point was in December of 06. Basically, I've lost everything that the company and I put into the fund this year. If this is the disaster they say it is, hey, I don't know if I can work for another 10 years, you know, 10, 20 years. Oh, you got time to make this up. I don't.
Well, my name is Mary David, and I live in Los Angeles. I am going to be 64 years old. It turns out that the golden years are a bit tarnished. I think we're kind of in the bronze. Since I have no control over what the financial market is doing right now, I thought, well, I won't look, but just last night, I thought, well, maybe I'll just take a peek. In the last year, I've lost $14,000 of my amassed tiny nest egg. Time is not on my side. I think maybe the $14,000 will come back. I don't know whether I will. I might be pushing daisies by that time. I have no idea. It's not that I want to sit and eat bonbons. I would still want to be useful. For instance, I would love to be a docent at the museum, but I'm going to have to just be working.
Listeners from across the country telling us this week how Wall Street's convulsions are affecting them. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. One thing all of us have in common is confusion over just how much we should save for retirement, and Wall Street's woes make you wonder about that number even more. Lee Eisenberg wrote a book a couple of years ago called The Number, and we've brought him back to talk about it. Lee, remind us, what is The Number?
I am not, let me say right here, a financial planner, and I'm not here to give financial advice, and God help you if you accept inadvertently any financial advice that I leave behind.
Okay.
First, and then the number refers to how much money each of us thinks we need in order to be relatively comfortable and secure over the remaining decades of our lives or the retirement period. A lot of the book talks about something that we tend not to think about quite as much, which is what is it that's really going to make us happy over those decades? And there are a lot of financial planners, enlightened financial planners, who take the position that until you figure out what kinds of things that will make you happy and productive, it's kind of hard to sit around and crunch numbers in the dark without knowing what are the things that are really going to make you feel happy.
Well, given that, how do you go about determining a number?
Well, what's left, and unfortunately a lot of people have to do this retroactively, what's left is careful financial planning over, you know, a good healthy period of time, which too many of us don't do. The point I make in the book was that I could not, in the pages of one book, tell each and every man and woman in America how much he or she needed to feel safe and secure for the rest of their lives.
And in fact, we are not able to do that on a weekly basis on this program.
Well, no one can do it unless you're sitting down with if you don't know how to do it yourself, sitting down with an advisor mm-hmm. who can take into account all of the variables that add up to you. One of the really heartening things is that if we start asking ourselves, what will really make me feel useful and productive? Generally speaking, the things that will make us happy tend not to be expensive things. A lot of people say, I never got to exercise some creative impulse. Other people say, you know, I never gave back enough. I didn't give back to a community or a school or the planet. We may find out that we need a bit less money than we otherwise think we need. So there is a little bit of a silver lining in this, even though all of us have a lot of reasons to be apprehensive about what's going on out there today.
Well, in very practical terms then, how does someone who is, say, 55, 65, or perhaps in retirement at 75, take that advice and use it in a practical way to not panic?
This may seem surprising to you. The first thing to do is talk about these things. It was extraordinary to me when I went around asking people of those ages, you know, so what are you really worried about? Other than health care, people have really not thought about those questions. You know, they seem to define their retirements in material terms and not necessarily in emotional terms. And often they don't share their anxieties with a spouse or a financial advisor who can be trusted and all the rest. So the first practical step is share what you got and share what you're concerned about. The other obvious practical answer is maximize your 401k, take advantage of company matches. And then I guess the third piece of practical advice is make sure that you're diversified. You know, one of the enormous sources of anguish today is that most people's nest egg was their house. And just as it's foolhardy to take 70 or 80% of your assets and buy a single stock, it's just as foolhardy to put all of your eggs under one roof, as it were.
Lee Eisenberg is the author of The Number, and thanks so much for discussing The Number with us in these tough times.
Thank you, Tess.
Maybe your kids are in the back seat right now, or playing in the next room, while you're listening to our ongoing coverage of the financial turmoil. What do you think they're picking up from all the voices around them? Talking to your kids about the economic meltdown, plus your questions, and the Washington Mutual takeover. It's all coming up next on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland, and we are continuing our coverage of the financial crisis. At this point, you're probably wondering if the bad news will ever stop. Well, your kids might be wondering, too. We sent producer Stephen Hoffman out to ask a few of them what they know about the Wall Street cooties.
I have been watching the news all day.
What do you think would happen if no one had money anymore?
I would just not buy anything.
Really?
Mm-hmm. I could go to another country and get it, like Detroit.
What do you think would happen if your family didn't have any money?
Then we wouldn't have enough money to pay off our house.
I think I would probably ask how we were going to get along in life with, like, food and clothes and all that.
Oh, that's not good. Don't think that way, kids. And Mom and Dad, don't let them. For some advice on how to talk to the young'uns about this mess, we turn to Kiplinger's Janet Bodner. And Janet, if a parent is worried about the economy, it's pretty likely, isn't it, that their kids are going to pick up on that?
Kids pick up on any kind of tension in the household between you and your spouse, no matter what it is. Even if they don't understand the particulars of what's going on, they may understand that there's something wrong here, or mom is worried, or dad is worried. And so that's something for parents to be aware of.
How does it manifest? How do they tend to react so that you can be aware as a parent that they are actually kind of worried about what's going on?
Well, I think what would normally happen is that they might come up with a question for you. Maybe your knee-jerk reaction would be, well, the kids are too young to really deal with this, and so you might want to just kind of say, oh, well, you don't have to worry about that. And that's really not what you want to do, because that kind of worries them a little more. So I think just listening for questions that they might ask, or turning the question on them and saying, do you understand what's going on here, or what do you think is going on? And just seeing what response you get, because you may get something that is totally off the wall and unexpected that you can easily deal with.
How much information would you say is too much? Does that depend on how old they are?
Exactly, Tess. It really is an age-appropriate thing. So let's say you're worried about losing a job, then you might want to discuss with your kids, you know, less money available. Or even if you're not losing a job, maybe you want to pull back a little bit. You might want to talk about that with the kids. Well, you're going to have a shorter list this year. We're going to cut back because we want to save our money. We're going to put money into the bank. Just sort of preparing the kids for not asking for a lot for Christmas, that sort of thing.
But how do you get that message across that spending might be a little different? In general, as you mentioned, perhaps a job loss, which has accompanied a lot of this credit crunch. How do you make sure that that doesn't get the kids worried? Because they must be pretty aware of their financial situation.
Well, first of all, I think what you would say, if a job loss were certainly the issue, you would tell the kids what you would do in the event of a job loss. You would say, well, I'm going to be switching work, or I'm not going to be going back to my regular job, but this is what I'm going to be doing, taking advantage of outplacement facilities that your former employer is going to be offering you. You would be looking for a new job. And if you could convey that to the kids in a reassuring way, that sort of thing can be very helpful for kids. And it doesn't necessarily have to be worrisome, especially if you give them some advantage. Warning.
Janet Bodner is deputy editor of Kiplinger's Personal Finance Magazine and also the author of Raising Money Smart Kids. Janet, thanks for helping me become an even more money smart radio host.
My pleasure, Tess.
So we've taken care of the kids, but what about the adults? To find out, we've brought back three of our favorite personal finance bloggers. Steve blogs for BripBlap.com, Lene blogs for BeingFrugal.net, and Jim blogs for PFBlueprint.com. And hi, Jim. Welcome back.
Thanks for having us.
And Steve, hello.
Thanks for having us back again, Tess.
And Lene, welcome back as well.
Hi.
Jim, let me start with you. What have you been posting about?
The biggest thing I've been posting about is any sort of upcoming news. For example, on Thursday, I wrote about the $700 billion bailout package. And for the most part, telling people that we should all calm down and not to make any rash decisions yet.
You mean like buying or selling stocks?
Right. For example, last week, we saw that the stock market gaining and dropping hundreds of points, the most it has done in 6 years. After all was said and done, the close on Friday was nearly the same as the close the week before. So panicking is really the wrong thing to be doing right now.
How about you, Lene?
I've just been trying to be an encouragement to my readers. Today, I posted things I learned from my grandparents as they went through the Great Depression. And yeah, we're facing hard times, but throughout history, the United States has tended to face hard times, and this will pass. Just stay calm.
What kinds of advice did you post from your grandparents?
You know, they tended to have good times during the Great Depression, even though money was really tight, and their resilience paid off in the end. And in the end, they were all prosperous, and they came through it.
Steve, I took a look at your blog, and one thing that you said was that you were increasingly skeptical of the stock market.
That's correct. I actually do financial consulting on Wall Street. I'm skeptical because I think that what you see in the news, you know, shows that we're heading for some rough times. And I don't think we're heading for a Great Depression or anything on those terms. But if you're looking, for example, at ways to really build wealth long term, you know, you really have to be very careful to diversify at this point, because I think there are going to be a lot of places in the stock market that are going to be dead for years and years to come now. And I'm also afraid that the cure that's about to take place is probably going to be worse than the disease.
Jim, you mentioned that you were discussing on your blog a lot of the macroeconomics involved in the bailout plan. I did notice you're also tending towards some of the practicalities, for example, advising people that there's no reason to keep all of their money in one bank. And this has obviously been an issue for folks as they've been worried about bank solvency.
Right. I think that we should all believe in FDIC insurance and that we shouldn't panic with regards to bank failures. If you have more than $100,000, you really need to spread that out to another bank. It doesn't really cost you that much to open up another account, and that protection will let you sleep at night. You don't have to worry about the latest news about your bank.
Lene, on your website, you ask a question, whether any good could come out of this economic crisis. And what's your answer to that?
Yeah, I think so, if we're willing to learn from our mistakes. And I also think that frugality is going to become important in the coming months. And I think that's a good thing. I think for a long time, we've been a country of excess. And I think it's a time that we come back and realize what's really important and that having all these things isn't important.
Steve, I'm guessing you would agree with that, because I think I remember I saw a posting on your site that was something to the effect of, now's the time to focus on stupid expenses.
That's right. I mean, exactly what Lene just said, that I think there will be a new focus on frugality. You know, you have to start rethinking whether things are really necessary. And by really necessary, I don't mean that everybody needs to start drinking nothing but water and eating nothing but bread. But at the same time, there's not a person out there who couldn't cut some expenses out of their life. All that having been said, you still have to continue to think about building wealth and investing in something. You can't save your way to prosperity.
You can't save your way to prosperity.
I really think that's true, because you have to look at it and say that if you have an income at a certain level, inflation is picking up, you can only save so much. I don't think solely focusing on frugality or solely focusing on trying to make more money ever works, even in a time like this.
Steve, I want to pick up on something that you said earlier and ask both Jim and Lene to respond to it, which is that you said you didn't think that we were headed for, you know, something similar to the Great Depression. And it seems that that's really the headline. Jim, let me ask you to respond to that. How bad do you feel that it is right now?
I think that's hard to say. A lot of this is born out of fear. And one of the things that I liked about Lene's answer of going back to more frugal times or less spending is that that's something that we can control. I think you should focus less on whether we're going into a depression and more on the things that you can control, which is spending a little less so that you can boost up your emergency fund in the event that something bad does happen. It'll give you the ability to sleep at night.
I absolutely agree with Jim. I'm no economist, so I don't know if it's going to get really bad or not. All you can do is control what you can. And so you just, you know, need to focus on that and trust the government to do their job, which is hard sometimes, but, you know, and eventually it's just going to play out however it plays out. And, you know, you can't control anything more than what you do yourself. So that's what you need to focus on.
Well, thank you all again for joining us and for giving us a little perspective.
Thank you, Tess.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for having us.
And we'll have links to all their websites on ours, marketplace.org. All right, it is time once again for Getting Personal, and back with us is Chris Farrell. Hello again, Chris.
Hello, Tess.
And once again this week, our email and voicemail were full of questions about this ongoing economic crisis as it unfolds. So we are going to take as many as we can this week. And Chris, let's start right out with an email from Elizabeth in New York. She wrote us about some funds that she has in a money market mutual fund with MetLife, the insurance company. MetLife has told her that the funds are guaranteed, that MetLife itself has insurance. Tell us about this. Is this a safe place for her nest egg?
It turns out this is a very safe place for her nest egg, especially compared to 2 weeks ago. The U.S. taxpayer, I guess we call that technically the U.S. Treasury / federal government, but really the U.S. taxpayer, the American taxpayer, is now backstopping the money market mutual fund industry. And that includes both your taxable money market mutual funds and your tax-exempt or muni money market mutual funds. So it's quite a stunning development. If I or you put a dollar into a money market mutual fund, our expectation always is that we get our dollar back when we need it. Plus, hopefully we make some interest, right? I mean, we'd like to make some interest, but at least we get our dollar back. That pledge the U.S. taxpayer is now saying it's good.
So it really doesn't even matter what MetLife has told Elizabeth about its insuring itself. The government is insuring it right now.
In essence, you're absolutely right. But I personally like the extra layers of insurance. I like the layer of protection from a very large insurance company, a very large financial institution. In the environment that we're in, the more layers of protection you have, the more comfortable I am.
Okay. Well, you know, a lot of people are just starting to save for their retirement, and they're wondering how much risk to assume. And Ted in New York City is one of them.
Starting my first job, very exciting, but not sure how to allocate my 401k contribution. My employer matches a percentage of my income, and I have about 15 mutual funds to choose from, leaning towards bonds and cash given the market volatility.
Now, Ted, I'm making a safe assumption, has a long-term time horizon, as opposed to somebody that is 62 in contemplating retirement over the next year or two. So for someone like Ted, you know, I really go back to the basics about diversification. You want to have some equities. You want to have some international equities. You want to have some bonds. I love Treasury inflation-protected securities, so-called TIPS, so you don't have to worry about inflation. I think for most people in the kind of environment we're in, particularly young people, I choose that option for now. And then over the next year or two, as you learn more about what's happening in the markets and some of the choices you may want to make in that 401k, you can make adjustments later on. He has time on his side.
Let's take a look at the banks. And a lot of them are trying to get all of us to park more of our cash with them because that helps them out with the bottom line.
Well, I think they're succeeding.
I think they are as well. And, you know, lots of people are pulling at least some of their money out of stocks now and going into things like CDs. Moira in Grand Rapids, Michigan, wrote to us, and she said she is buying CDs through her Vanguard account where she can bid for FDIC-insured CDs from small regional banks. She says the rates are around 4% for a one-year CD. She thinks this is a little too good to be true compared to, money market, treasuries, other bank CDs that she's seen. So she's wondering if somehow she's taking a risk that she's not aware of.
As long as she's under the $100,000, I think buying what are called brokered CDs is a perfectly sensible strategy. 4%. And for example, if you go to some of the online banks like ING, they'll offer a one-year certificate of deposit currently at 4%. So banks are trying to attract more money. They are succeeding in attracting more money. If the bank gets in trouble, and a lot of banks are getting into trouble, you may not get access to your money right away. But remember, it's a CD, so that's not much of an issue because you've locked it up for a period of time. But your money is absolutely safe.
Let's stick with CDs. And Virginia here in Los Angeles is one of many, many people who've written in over the last couple of weeks to ask how their credit union accounts are insured.
A friend of mine tells me the credit unions are just insured by the state. That's not as secure as the federal government. How safe am I? Did my friend make a mistake?
When you're talking about your safety money, you want to be backstopped by the federal government. You know when you walk into a bank and it has that logo, that symbol, FDIC? So when you walk into a credit union, you want to see, does it have NCUSIF, called the National Credit Union Share Insurance Fund? Try and say that fast. It's essentially the same thing as the FDIC, except for it's for federal credit unions.
Okay. Well, we are answering your personal finance questions around the clock right now. You can call us at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Or write to us at marketplace.org. Just click on the Getting Personal link there. And we will be back with more Getting Personal later in the program.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider that offers products and planning tools to help their nearly 3 million members and their communities thrive. More at thrivent.com. And by Gather.com, where friends keep up with the people, conversations, and moments that matter most. People are talking about the economy at Gather.com. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Fund, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet.
And this is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. All right. We're still getting lots of concern coming into our inbox about bank safety, and this week did not provide much relief on that front. Washington Mutual, the nation's largest savings and loan, was taken over by J.P. Morgan in something of a midnight massacre. Not that we didn't see it coming. WaMu's share price has been steadily eroding for a couple of weeks. But joining us once again is Marketplace Senior Business Correspondent Bob Moon. Hello again, Bob.
Hey, Tess. Now, I just got this offer in the mail here. It's from
WaMu.
Uh-huh. Now, do you think it's any good?
I'm hoping that it is.
Actually, that is the answer. It's
okay.
Probably still good. They're probably going to extend me whatever credit they've offered here.
If you take it.
Yes. And we'll see where that goes.
You know, if you've got an account at Washington Mutual, what happens to your money?
We've been talking a lot about how your deposits are insured by the FDIC up to $100,000, $200,000 in a joint account. Well, that doesn't apply in this case, and that's good news, because what's happened here is, regardless of the dollar amount in your WaMu account, nobody lost any money, because all the deposit accounts have simply been transferred to J.P. Morgan Chase. Now, that includes checking, savings, money market, retirement, all certificates of deposit. So even if your money wasn't fully insured by the FDIC here, you don't lose access to any of your money, and it should be business as usual.
So you really shouldn't see any difference at all. You'll be able to go to the ATM. You'll be able to write checks. This is just a bank merger, basically.
That's right. You're going to get your money with the same interest rates if it's an interest-bearing deposit account. If you have, let's say, a loan through WaMu, you keep making your checks payable to Washington Mutual for now. You'll be mailing them to the same place. If you set up a direct withdrawal for a payment, that should work the same, and your due date should be the same along with your payment.
Now for the bad news, if I'm a WaMu shareholder.
Ooh, yeah, you've pretty much lost all your stock value there. You've got the lowest priority in a receivership, and what happened here is that J.P. Morgan bought the banking part, but they didn't buy the holding company or the management part. I would advise you to check with your accountant. Maybe you have a tax loss to declare here.
Just to repeat again, all the branches are going to stay open. All the ATMs are going to work. This is business as usual.
That's right. In fact, Jamie Dimon, the CEO of J.P. Morgan Chase, said in his conference call late Thursday night that he's treating this exactly like a traditional merger. That means you're going to eventually see a rebranding to Chase Bank. And listen to Mr. Dimon talking about how he sees this as a strong acquisition, not something he's going to be turning around and liquidating.
We think that this builds a great franchise for us. Obviously, we add a whole bunch of states, California, Florida, and enhanced states we're already in. You know, we're building this franchise for the long term, not for next year or the next 5 years, but for the next 100 years.
So that sure doesn't sound like a bank that's going to be on shaky ground going forward.
Boy, that is really nice to hear.
Reassuring.
Thanks so much, Bob. So, what will it take to get you to stop abusing your credit?
I'm sorry, sir, but it appears as though your credit card has been declined.
Did everyone hear that? This person right here, credit card declined.
Better credit through commercials. Plus, more of your questions on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Viglund. A Kaiser Family Foundation survey out this week found the total cost to insure a family's health care averages $12,680 a year. Of course, if you're self-employed, that probably sounds like a bargain. In this installment of our election series, Interested Parties, Ashley Milne Tite reports on what they want from their next president.
When you're your own boss, you pay every bill yourself. Many of the self-employed say the bill that really holds them back is health care. Keith Franks owns an auto repair shop outside Pittsburgh. His only staff is his bookkeeper and wife, Carolyn. They have two teenagers. 10 years ago, Franks paid $540 a month for a family health insurance policy. By this year, it cost $1,500. This spring, it shot up to $2,400 a month.
When we received this latest increase, it was numbing. I can't possibly work 24 hours a day, 7 days a week to pay for it. But you certainly want to have it. You want to have your family covered.
Keith and Carolyn are in their early 50s, and Carolyn has a chronic condition. The couple found a cheaper plan, but it's still $1,900 a month. It has a higher deductible and copays, so Carolyn thinks twice before going to the doctor. They have other concerns, too. Keith says if health insurance didn't eat up more than a third of his income, he'd make plenty of improvements.
Well, some of my dream projects, obviously, at this point, getting older, I would like to back off on working so many hours. and expand, you know, a little bit larger repair shop and add some employees.
The candidates are talking about making health insurance more affordable and available. But lately, Keith's been thinking universal health care may be the way to go.
You know, everybody talks about they want government less involved, but on an issue this large, I have to believe that might be a better system.
Joe Mandy also says it's time for government to step in. Mandy's lifestyle is a far cry from the Franks. He's a 25-year-old stand-up comedian in New York City with no one to support but himself.
As I'm walking back, I'm like, ooh, that feels kind of weird.
Okay. Mandy does buy health insurance. He says he's so clumsy, he needs it.
Like, I was chopping onions one time and I sliced my finger, and another time it was raining and I slipped down the stairs at the subway and cut my hand on broken glass.
He says comedy is tough enough to break into without paying hundreds a month for health insurance.
If you want to pursue something that's not in a giant company or some sort of cubicle thing, you get punished. You have to figure out your own health insurance. I mean, that shouldn't be the case. You should be able to do what you want.
Patty Crow of Arlington, Virginia says you can. She runs her own publishing business. Her husband is a self-employed carpenter. Crow doesn't see herself as a victim.
Someone might say, oh my gosh, you've had, you know, $100,000 or more in medical expenses in the last 10 years or so. How can you consider yourself fortunate? Well, I do, because we've managed to cope.
The Crows only buy catastrophic health insurance. Patty says they try to eat well, take vitamins, and avoid the doctor. But when their eldest son was 15, he developed a brain tumor. The Crows had to pay a $10,000 deductible before the insurance kicked in. Other expenses weren't covered. 2 years later, the tumor returned, and they had to start the whole process again. Several years later, they're still paying off medical bills. Still, Crow says she doesn't want a government-run healthcare system.
I believe that the more areas such as healthcare and any other areas regulated by the federal government, I think it opens the door to a tremendous amount of error and misjudgments, because it's so far down to the man on the street. And I also believe that it removes the individual citizen from responsibility in a way.
But Crow resents what she says is greed and corruption at pharmaceutical companies. She'd welcome some government intervention to lower the cost of drugs and the unseemly profits she says they generate. Her biggest concern is Social Security. As a self-employed couple, she and her husband contribute twice as much as company employees do. Crow says the government's so in debt, she's afraid they won't get a penny back. But she's not losing sleep like Keith Franks is. He's so worried about his overall financial security, he's begun to question whether being his own boss still makes sense.
I go to bed wondering how you will pay for health care. Where will it be next year? I never thought at 50, let alone 80, I'd be this concerned about how do I pay for my health care.
Recently, he ended up in the hospital with pneumonia. A nurse told him his 65-hour work week wasn't helping. After 10 days away from the shop, Franks was anxious to reopen and start making money again. Patty Crow says she and her husband have no doubts about their employment status. Is it worth it?
For us, absolutely. We love being self-employed, being your own boss and creating your own products that you believe in and presenting them to the world. It's wonderful.
The only question, she says, is when or whether they'll be able to retire. I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace Money.
We are back with more Getting Personal, your questions about the financial crisis as we help you deal with it throughout the program. And Chris is back with us. Chris, let's go right to the phones again. Tammy in Long Beach called in with a question about AIG.
We have a life insurance policy with AIG, and I was actually going to buy another one, but since AIG is in financial trouble, I don't know if we should transfer our policy or if we should just stay put. I'm not even sure if we should even start looking for another life insurance policy, because we don't know what companies to go with anymore.
Well, Chris, I wonder if there are maybe two questions here. It sounds like, one, she wants to know if she should even buy life insurance right now. And number two, I'm guessing that she wants to know if she should stick with AIG.
So in terms of should you buy life insurance now, that's going to be dictated by your family. Don't worry about what's going on in the market. There are good companies out there despite the problems that have happened with AIG. So if you need life insurance, boy, I would not let this market turmoil stop you from doing it. Would I keep my policy with AIG? Yes. Because remember, all the problems has to do with the parent company. The insurance company, which is regulated by the states, is set off to the side. It's well capitalized. And so far, we don't see any problems with the insurance company. We see the problems with the nationalized parent company.
But would you recommend that they buy the second one with AIG? And if not, how do you find a good life insurance company?
No, I wouldn't buy another life insurance policy with them. I think, you know, are you going to reward them with my business? You know, you go with the big company that's too big to fail, whether that's too big to fail by the federal government's rules or by the state regulatory rules.
All right, let's go to Barry in Minneapolis, and he wrote to us about T-bills. And his question was, why are the short-term T-bills so volatile? A couple of weeks ago, the three-month rate was about 1.7%. Earlier this week, this past week, it was at less than 1%. And this is really what sparked a lot of the concern on Wall Street, isn't it? What happened a week ago last Wednesday when the T-bill actually fell below zero, didn't it? It went negative?
It went negative. And Tessa, I was sitting in front of the Bloomberg machine, and you have all the numbers from the market flashing, and my jaw just kept going like a cartoon, dropping down farther and farther, because the T-bill hit zero. It hit zero. And then, as you said, as I understand it, even went negative. The T-bill is considered the safest security in the world. And so money from everywhere wasn't just American citizens. It was global. It was from around the world. Everyone went, I want to be safe. I got to be safe. I don't want to take a risk. And so it was a flight to safety that just drove down the yield on the T-bill. And it's one of the signs, one of sort of the market signals about how great the panic was that day. It's still yielding less than 1%. I mean, that's almost nothing.
So it's pretty much the equivalent at that point, if you're getting zero, of putting it under the mattress, right?
Except you don't have to worry about a fire. You don't have to worry about understanding FDIC insurance. I think it's stunning. This is just a pure, safe play. However much money you want to put in there, it's not at risk.
Let's go to Vermont, and Kathleen is 44 years old, so she has some time for her investments to bounce back. But this week in Time magazine, she read that the guy who is guiding a big chunk of her Legg Mason mutual funds is taking some big risks.
The magazine gave Miller a grade D and called him the gambler because he's been buying up a bunch of Freddie Mac stock. So I'm wondering at this point whether I should sell my Legg Mason stock and take the loss, or whether I should hold on to it, and if so, how long I should give Miller to turn it around.
All right, Chris, what kind of grade would you like to give Bill Miller? And do you think that she should give him some time to recover here?
I would give him time. Now, I'm a big Bill Miller fan, and I disagree with giving him a D. Bill Miller has had one of the best runs in the country for 15, 16, 17 years, beating the Standard & Poor's 500 each year. But what I really like about his record is that he doesn't own that many stocks. It's a very concentrated portfolio.
But one of the ones that he owned was, Freddie Mac.
Right, and he hasn't been doing well. He has not been doing well. It's been a horrible period of time. I don't know if you watched how many of the best and brightest were buying Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac.
Yeah, even just in the couple of months before the government took it over.
That's right. So, you know, look, it's a bad performance. I would say terrific long-term track record. His reputation is on the line. I'd stick with him.
Well, Chris, unfortunately, that's all the time we've got for questions on the show. But we are taking more and more and more. So please do call us. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Or send us an email. Chris might answer it on his blog, or we'll use it on the air. And you can find all of the information that we've been giving here at marketplace.org. Chris, boy, thanks for going through the marathon with me.
Thanks a lot, Tess.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider that offers products and planning tools to help their nearly 3 million members and their communities thrive. More at thrivent.com. And by FINRA Investor Education Foundation, helping inform today's investor through innovative grant-making and educational funding. Online at finrafoundation.org. And by Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build stronger customer relationships through email marketing. ConstantContact.com.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. In the midst of all this Wall Street craziness, we pause to acknowledge a birthday. Credit cards turn 50 this month. The only present they're getting is House passage of a law that would crack down on fees and usurious interest rates. Credit card troubles often start in college, and so this month, the Treasury Department is targeting 18 to 24-year-olds with a new ad campaign. Rachel Dornhelm reports.
This is nice.
I was hoping you'd like it. It's my special
risk. I'm sorry, sir, but it appears as though your credit card has been declined.
Did everyone hear that? This person right here, credit card declined.
Oh. Does this ad make you think twice seconds. About using a credit card? The Treasury Department certainly hopes so, especially if you're a young adult. Kathy Crosby is a senior vice president at the Ad Council. She says a year of research showed the Treasury 18 to 24-year-olds don't understand the pitfalls of credit cards.
They all associated poor credit and poor credit scores with way in the future, and that's not going to be relevant to me because I'm going to be making so much money that it doesn't really matter what I do now.
A recent study found 90% of college students have credit cards. More than half of them rack up $5,000 in credit card debt while in school. Crosby says the new ad campaign warns what can happen if they have bad credit. Future employers could turn them down. They could find it difficult to buy a car. Or, as in this ad, even to find a place to live.
Thank you so much for showing me another apartment. That last apartment looked more like a tool shed.
That's because it was a tool shed, dear.
The ads got the thumbs up from some students, like UC Berkeley junior Andrew Pereiro.
I have friends, like, because I'm 22, and I have friends who are already in, like, pretty bad debt with credit cards, and I've just been like, I don't have one. That's my solution, is I don't even want to have that temptation.
Not everyone's lucky enough to be able to live without a credit card. Amari Childs is a senior at Berkeley. He says the ads didn't resonate with him because they showed kids overspending on things like snowboards.
It made it seem as though students were getting things that were frivolous and that wasn't necessarily needed, when my experience when using credit cards was things that were necessities.
Childs says he built up $4,000 in debt from buying food and train passes. He had to take a year off school to pay the debt down. Child says he'd like to see campuses offer to teach students about credit. Robert Bugai writes about credit card marketing. He says the credit card companies do offer some education, but not much.
The money spent to let students know more about how to manage their money is very small. It's pocket change compared to the actual marketing of credit cards to students, and it's always been that way.
But times do change. The Ad Council's Crosby points out that the headlines recently have shown clearly the dangers of binging on credit.
Well, as we like to say, this is certainly a teachable moment.
She says all the news about Wall Street's woes may make students more receptive to an ad campaign warning them about the dangers of debt. In Berkeley, I'm Rachel Dornhelm for Marketplace Money.
Something's been lost in all the talk about the economy. People in the Gulf region are still dealing with the aftermath of Hurricane Ike. On this week's A Day in the Work Life, we'll meet someone who doesn't have the luxury of forgetting.
Okay, so you need the number. I asked for nurses and I asked for...
I'm Paige Roberts, executive director of the Southeast Mississippi chapter of the American Red Cross.
And I asked for 10 supervisors.
This is a special area because we're so close to the Gulf, and it's really fun, and it's also really scary because the same water that we like to fish in and we like to boat on is also the same water that can come in and destroy our houses. It makes me laugh about the saying, come hell or high water, because both hell and high water came a few years ago, and we're all still very aware of it. A typical day is crazy. I come in with a to-do list, and I rarely get to it. I'm dealing with people who have had fires, planning. I'm constantly planning for hurricane season and for any other disaster. The character of a pit bull would be helpful in the sense that you have to be as tenacious as you can because you're constantly trying to get resources. I'm trying to find partners. We really don't have anything ourselves. You know, even our shelters, we don't own them. So we have to go make agreements with the people who do own them. I guess I should have gone to Donald Trump's school of how to make a deal, because the art of the deal is what I do. My salary is something I think that is the one surprise to everyone. I make $41,000 a year. I started at $30,000. It's hard to talk about training because when I took this job, the only Red Cross experience I'd ever had was as a blood donor. There isn't a special how to run a Red Cross course you can take in college. You know, there isn't a degree you can get in this, but life is the training. Having relationships and an ability to network, that is the best education for this job. The best thing about this job is knowing that I have made a difference in someone's life so significantly that if I hadn't been where I was doing what I was doing at that very moment, their life would have been completely different. If I died tomorrow, I would know that I would be okay because of that work.
That was Paige Roberts of the American Red Cross. A Day in the Work Life was reported by Judith Ritter. And that is Marketplace Money for this week. Keep your questions coming during this time of financial uncertainty. We will have more answers on next week's program. And check out marketplace.org for the latest developments. Marketplace Money is produced by Nancy Fargali with Stephen Hoffman, Eve Tro, Jim Wallace, and the rest of the Marketplace staff. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yor. Remember, talk to your own expert before you make any big money decisions. I'm Tess Vigeland. We'll see you next week.
Want to hear something on Marketplace Money again? Help is as near as your home computer. To find audio archives of past programs and information on transcripts, just go to the internet and log on to our website. The information you need when you need it is only a few clicks away. Just point your browser to marketplace.org. Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider that offers products and planning tools to help their nearly 3 million members and their communities thrive. More at thrivent.com.
American Public Media.